very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson. This is the show that looks behind the headlines, talking to the correspondents who bring the stories to the front pages. Ahead in the next hour, we talk to a journalist about her near miss with the Syrian authorities. We get the latest from a Greek economist on the Eurozone crisis, and we head to Moscow to find out how the Russians are building up their airports. That's all that right here in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso made a heartfelt appeal today for Greeks to unite behind the latest EU financial aid package. Barroso warned that Greek citizens would suffer if they voted against the €130 billion bailout package in the surprise referendum, which was called by Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou yesterday. Oliver Roth of Close Brothers Seidler Bank says the implications could be catastrophic.
The worst case scenario is right now that if Greece is really rejecting the rescue package, the European rescue package, that it might blow up the whole euro system.
We've just heard that the European Union and the IMF will not release an €8 billion payment to Greece until after the country has held that referendum on the EU's bailout programme. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has warned there'll be no hope for peace in his war-ravaged nation without help from its neighbours to combat terror groups. He's attending a global conference in Turkey aimed at mapping out Afghanistan's future. Representatives from 20 countries have joined aid agency members at the Istanbul talks. The Arab League said today the Syrian government had approved an Arab plan for dialogue with the opposition and steps to end 7 months of bloodshed. That's according to a League statement released during a ministerial meeting in Cairo. And just in, Syria has agreed to withdrawing its military presence from cities and residential areas and to releasing prisoners as part of an Arab initiative to end 7 months of violence. That's just in from the Arab League. Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh has moved a step closer to handing power to his deputy by accepting a UN formula to ease a transition and an uprising against his rule. The United Nations transition plan requires Saleh to shift power to Vice President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi ahead of an early presidential election. American surgeons have successfully separated conjoined two-year-old girls born in the Philippines. A medical team of 40 in California spent 9 hours operating on Angelina and Angelica Sabuco, who'd been joined at the chest and abdomen. Their mother, Gennady, was tearful after finding out things had gone smoothly.
We thank Dr. Gary Hartman and the team. My family will be grateful eternally. God bless us all.
Finally, Barack Obama topped Forbes' list of the world's most powerful people in 2011 as the US leader's clout rose after the deaths of al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Obama bumped Chinese President Hu Jintao from the number one spot on the magazine's annual rankings. German Chancellor Angela Merkel remained the most powerful woman at number four on the list as Europe's largest economy continued to wield its influence over the troubled European Union. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who's running again for president, was number two, and Hu came third as he gradually manages the transition of power to others in China. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. Now let's take a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And big contrasts in the weather on the way across Europe for the second half of the week. Atlantic weather fronts are fast approaching. Western Europe and the whole of Iberia, parts of France, the UK will have rain. It'll turn very breezy too. But with southerly winds across the continent, it means it'll be, of course, mild. More central and eastern parts of Europe, however, will remain dry and there'll be some sunshine too. Here's your city forecast for tomorrow, that's Thursday. London, a wet morning with afternoon showers, but despite the rain, it'll still be 17 degrees. That's 7 degrees above the average for November. In Paris, some rain as well on Thursday, highs of 17 degrees. In Stockholm, cloudy, cooler at 11. And in Moscow, also cloudy, 8 degrees, the high on Thursday in Moscow. And as far as air travel goes and the jet stream, if you're flying from Western Europe to the US, because of the position of the jet stream, you'll have quite a headwind and maybe a longer journey to America too. The jet stream is blowing out of northern Quebec. It's a very wide jet stream. There's no avoiding it as far as the westbound flights are concerned. Air travel across Central Europe, however, much calmer skies here. Okay, over to North America, and a snowstorm over the Rockies affecting Colorado. Denver getting up to 20 centimeters of snow early on Wednesday. Local time, very difficult conditions there. Blizzards expected too, with winds up to 80 kilometers an hour. So very rough weather in some parts of the US yet again. Meanwhile, in California, it's warm and sunny. And the Atlantic seaboard during Wednesday and into Thursday, calm and sunny. So nice weather all the way from Miami to Maine. The city forecast then for Wednesday into Thursday, Denver, lots of snow, blizzards too. In Chicago, rain heading here and turning colder, 9 the high on Thursday. Washington, sunny and mild at 15. New York City, lovely fall sunshine here, 15 degrees is the high. And air travel, delays at airports possible across the Rockies due to the snowstorm. The weather for flights to and from the Atlantic seaboard looking good during Wednesday and Thursday, and the jet stream will push you along a little bit with a good tailwind if you're flying over eastern Canada to London, for example. And a quick look at South America now. We have some great weather across the south of Brazil and also across Argentina. Buenos Aires, Wednesday and Thursday, warm and sunny with highs of 26 degrees. Rio also looking sunny, highs here of 24. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your song.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After another Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with Emma Nelson. Well, until 48 hours ago, everything appeared to have been neatly tidied up for Greece. At last week's meeting in Brussels, Eurozone leaders told them that Greece would have half of its debt written off in return for even more cuts in spending. But over the past 48 hours, things have taken a turn for a surreal, because the country's Prime Minister, George Papandreou, has said that this proposal had to be the subject of a referendum. Since then, the markets have fallen. The Greek finance minister has been admitted to hospital with stomach pains, and Mr. Papandreou is expected to spend a lot of this evening being talked to by Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy. Well, for the latest on this, I'm joined by Vicky Price, who is a Greek-born economist at FDI Consulting. She's also former joint head of the UK's government economic service as well. A very warm welcome to you. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House, Vicky. Not too much of an exaggeration to say that Mr. Papandreou has basically caused chaos?
Well, he has. I mean, we've seen already what's been going on in the markets. So, indeed, he has unsettled sentiment very significantly. And, of course, this evening he will have to do a lot of explaining to Merkel and Sarkozy, which is basically what's going on. Everyone's been shocked about this. No one expected that he would announce a referendum. But when you sit back and think a little bit about it, you can understand that there is a serious issue in Greece, which is one of implementing any of the sort of agreements that have been made in terms of the austerity package and the conditions for the bailout and so on, because the population doesn't like it. And his own ministers and his own MPs have at various times been very anti any of the austerity measures that had to be voted in so far. He has a very slim majority. And the truth is that he needs to do something about having a proper mandate to carry any of those reforms through. And he doesn't have it at present, and he needs to get it. And perhaps he sees this as a way of finally getting the backing he needs to push these things through.
What are the options for Greece, though, if the He's basically faced with two options, isn't he? If he doesn't go for a referendum and just agrees to what was offered to him last week in Brussels, a third of Greek's debt will go, and the European banks will bear the brunt of this. And these will be, you know, the likes of Sokgen, whose price has fallen quite dramatically in the last 48 hours. But that would be sustained by European funds and this bailout fund, by this new European bailout fund. But if the Greeks vote no, the default that Greece is expected to have anyway will be a 90 to 100% default. And this will apply to anyone, and that will cause absolute pandemonium.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think the deal was a good one. It's entirely possible that we might need even more of a haircut. In other words, sort of more of a write-down of debt than the 50% that's been agreed at some stage in the future, and I think that is entirely likely to happen. But what you would have had, and hopefully you still will have, is an orderly default, which includes a lot of sort of voluntary write-downs by the banks that are holding Greek debt. The real issue now is that if the whole thing doesn't go through as was planned, indeed, we're going to see the Greek banks themselves becoming bankrupt, the Greek population losing an awful lot of money. And then we're going to see contagion spreading very significantly. We're already seeing what's going on in Italy. And what will happen is that the banks are going to have an even bigger problem in terms of the debt they hold, which will be worthless. We already saw earlier that the banks were beginning to be very distrustful of each other. They weren't lending the money. And in fact, the cost of borrowing has been increasing in Europe overall because of that. And would, of course, lead, if indeed we have the default that you're worried about at some point with huge write-down of debt, that would lead to another credit crunch of exactly the sort we saw at the beginning of the previous financial crisis in 2008. But so indeed, the repercussions are significant if Greece votes no.
But in addition to this this fear of another crunch, there's also the enormous question of the future of the euro, because I think it's the French Prime Minister François Fillon has said that Greece has to decide whether it wants to stay or not in the eurozone, and the bailout offer that was given to it last week was effectively not up for negotiation, and if they don't agree to it, then it could actually spell the end of the euro in its current form.
Yes, and I think if Greece leaves the euro, then I think other countries will be forced to do so too, because the markets are going to pressurise, they're already doing it in Italy, but they're also going to pressurise again Spain, Italy, we've already mentioned Italy, but there's also Ireland and Portugal. And of course, we're already seeing what the French are suffering in terms of downgrades of the banks, which has been very significant. So there is a big, big issue for the whole of Europe. It isn't going to be just Greece leaving the euro, but actually the whole euro project will be at an end.
You talked about Italy. I mean, Italy had its crisis last week with its bond deal and its cost of borrowing now above 6%. To what extent are the Italians and the Greek problems sort of feeding off each other, or are they?
Well, they're not necessarily feeding off each other in terms of, you know, what's going on in Greece in terms of the economy. It's very different to what's going on in Italy. But there is one exception to that, which is that they're both growing very slowly. In fact, in the case of Greece, we're seeing GDP declining, and next year will be the fourth year of drop, if indeed the forecast of 2.2% decline next year materialized, after about 5.5% drop this year. Italy is having absolutely no growth at all. And as you've seen, the OECD had just downgraded Eurozone growth anyway. So a number of the countries are going to be finding they're stagnating, basically. And neither of them is generating enough growth, that's Italy and Greece, to be able to repay its debt or even pay the interest on it. And the moment you start having to pay interest rates of the sort that Italy is paying right now, then the debt becomes unsustainable. You simply cannot generate enough revenue to pay for this from your own resources, and the costs are too great.
It's also becoming a global issue, because not only, if we look at the European Commissioners for starters, the President, José Manuel Barroso, today has made a heartfelt appeal for the Greeks to unite behind this aid package. But also there are reports that even the Chinese have waded in, saying, please, Greece, do not do this, because this could jeopardise global markets.
Well, global markets have been affected by this quite significantly, and we've seen repercussions all across the world. The Chinese had already said that they would want to have lots of conditions on their own participation to any bailout fund, and actually everyone was looking to them to make some sort of serious contribution to the whole thing. That type of sort of condition that they would want would include some sort of certainty in terms of the returns that they may be getting, because, of course, as we know, the Chinese have been losing quite a lot of money in some of their things in the States, for example, and they want to be guaranteed, not necessarily guaranteed, but to have some sort of security that whatever happens in Europe now is going to be a very sensible sort of package of support for the countries that are in difficulty. The moment they find that that isn't the case, or isn't likely to be the case, and various countries can default at any stage during the process, they're not going to be that happy with the whole thing. And of course, the whole Eurozone issue, whether the euro will survive in the future, will not encourage any investors to step in.
Let's turn now to the country that's actually at the heart of this storm, and Greece and the Greeks themselves. We saw protests in the street last week in response to the offer, to the bailout zone. How are the Greeks responding to the fact that they are now being dragged in on a domestic democratic, in a domestic and democratic way, to actually decide something which is, which is being decided on an international scale unilaterally by the leaders?
Well, I think there's a bit of schizophrenia going on in Greece, and I see it in some of the newspapers and what people think about it all. One of the problems is that they thought for a while that perhaps they got the international community to understand and accept that Greece had problems, and therefore the help that finally came sort of was an acknowledgement of the fact that Greece needed to get a lot of support because it would never get out of its problems by itself. So that was fine. And they were feeling sort of reasonably happy that this happened. But I'm now not talking about the last summit meeting. I'm talking about July 21st. After July 21st, everyone thought that everything would be great. That was when the second bailout was agreed. The fact that it then took so long for Europe to agree, pass the whole deal through the various parliaments, has been a major problem for the Greeks because it's basically made the whole situation worse.
And what I mentioned when I introduced you that you are born in Greece. Do you have any sort of regular contact with people over there to describe what the situation is like? Because I was listening on the radio yesterday to a woman who said, "Look, we have got to do something about this because I can no longer sustain a monthly salary of €700 when the cost of living is escalating." How are the Greek people taking it?
Well, they're taking it very badly, and that's really why I was referring to the July 21st thing, because the expectation was that with the reduction in the debt, the sort of huge mountain of debt that was there, everyone thought for a while that perhaps the austerity measures would be eased. In other words, that there wouldn't be the need to really go to the whole length of cutting salaries even more, reducing pensions, reducing the number of people in public sector jobs, cutting back what councils were providing and all that sort of stuff, which of course is very important in Greece. And what they've seen since is that, in fact, if anything, the sort of expectation of everybody as a result of the second bailout is that they do even more. And I think that's what's really turned sentiment quite significantly negative. We've seen more protests. We've seen, since the second summit that took place last week, the mood has worsened in Greece. There is absolutely no respect for officials, no respect for the government. Really, the sort of rule of law is showing signs of deteriorating very significantly. The Greeks are simply not prepared to take any more hit on their pay packets and living standards. As we already know, suicides are increasing. People are joining the soup kitchens who are now Greek rather than just being immigrants. So people are beginning to feel hungry. And there is huge resentment in terms of the way that the whole thing's been put together. So in some ways, getting back some democratic accountability may not be a bad thing, even though it might be quite hurtful in the short term.
It does seem quite baffling, though, that you have such a strong negative reaction from the Greek people, yet Mr. Papandreou is expected to tell the French and German leaders that a referendum is the only way of overcoming resistance to even more cuts.
Well, he will say that, but that's, of course, his sort of trump card, if you like. Now, what everyone knows is that the austerity measures are just going to be too much for the Greeks to bear. So what Papandreou will need to do is explain that he's quite determined to achieve reform, but explain also that he will never get a referendum through if he doesn't get some concessions. And those concessions may well be, yes, an austerity package, but let's sit down and renegotiate perhaps, not necessarily very visibly, but let's renegotiate the time that it takes for us to achieve various targets. Let's make sure we get enough money from the Commission additionally in terms of structural funds, which are already beginning to come in without too much matching required by the Greeks. Let's get the money that's already been set aside, which is about, I think, €500 million for the moment, but it could be more, to help directly with loans to small and medium-sized enterprises. Let's see what we can do in terms of reforms that the Commission can facilitate to get the economy moving again, so that there is a light at the end of the tunnel for the Greeks. And if that happens, then he can sell a referendum with the types of questions that can make the sort of two choices. You know, we do this and we then move on to faster growth, or we leave the Eurozone and we're going to be in dire straits. You know, that type of referendum could well lead to a yes vote by the Greeks if they realize what the options are, which perhaps will have a bit of a sweetener in them for them to accept the yes vote.
Vicky Price, economist at FDI Consulting and Greek-born and also former joint head of the UK's Government Economic Service. Thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24. The time's just coming up to 21 minutes past the hour.
You can now download Monocle's first app featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed and our global 25-25 city guide series. With its unique time shift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex. For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop, stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Well, we heard in the news at the top of the hour that Syria has agreed to withdraw its military presence from cities and residential areas and to release prisoners as part of an Arab initiative to end 7 months of violence. This report came in from the Arab League within the last hour. On Monocle 24, we've had our Syria series all this week, listening to voices coming from Syria to describe exactly what is going on. Well, on Midori House, we have been able to talk to Ramita Navai. She's spent time in hiding with the Syrian opposition for the UK's Channel 4 programme Unreported World. She's spoken to Monocle 24 about her experiences inside the country and about a near miss she had with the authorities.
We'd meet activists who belonged to different opposition groups, but most of them were of the same sentiment. And it was quite remarkable just how many people are fighting to topple the regime, wherever we went. They're amazing at organising themselves. It's a really tight network. They have a really tight network of lookouts, for example, that spreads across the whole of the country. They communicate using Skype and Facebook. They think Skype is the safest way to communicate. They think that it's really hard to monitor Skype conversations, which it is. So they rarely use mobiles. And they have messengers as well. So when the system goes down, because this does happen when an area is raided or when there are mass protests, the government will take down, there'll be no electricity, they'll take down the mobile phone networks. So they'll use a system of messengers to communicate between the different opposition groups to send messages.
James, I know you were there as well quite recently. Did you find it impressive how quickly people have become organised? It's amazing within a matter of months how much infrastructure gets put in, you know, that people are organised and they have ways of communicating. That, you know, with when you've had a country where the opposition has been repressed for so long, so brutally, that this pops up so quickly.
It's really wonderful to experience, and Ramita will be able to explain this as well, when you witness such dynamism. And, you know, people have been talking a lot about the youth of the Arab Spring, but there is nowhere more where that's more obvious, really, than what I saw in Syria. When you stop an entire generation from being able to do anything at university other than things like IT and engineering and computing, they become very, very proficient on things like Facebook and building very quick and reliable internet communications and broadband communications with the international media as well and with each other. It's an exciting time for them, albeit very scary.
I'm curious to hear what it was like going in undercover.
We were a team of two. So we were posing as a Middle Eastern couple on holiday, and that was great cover. It worked. Because I don't know what your experience was, James, but when I was there, There were not many non-Middle Eastern people.
Yeah.
I mean, did you feel comfortable? Would you have really stood out? Were you aware that you looked very different?
I was aware of it, but the thing is that what you do is you become very, very conscious of who you have to avoid and who you don't. Because, as Ramita has been saying, the opposition is so widespread. It's not just, you know, an armed or non-armed opposition of men in the street doing protests. It's everyone. It's every family. It's every mother. It's every child. It's every father and brother. You know, it's every family. So you don't have to hide from these people. There's an unspoken knowledge there that they know why you're there. They know what you're doing. They won't say anything. They'll help you even. So yes, I did sort of joke with these guys before I went, you know, it's going to be a little bit like ferrying Tintin around the country. Because the opposition is so widespread, everyone is there to look out for you.
We've seen the interviews this week with Assad. We had Andrew Gilligan on the program earlier in the week, and he was saying you that Assad seems to be convinced that everything's normal and all tickety-boo. Or is it because, holed up in Damascus, life does seem normal?
I think he's lying. The minute you step outside Damascus, everywhere we went, mass protests. I was amazed what we saw in Douma, Harasta, the towns just north of Damascus. Thousands and thousands on the streets, not just on a Friday, when most people protest after prayers, but we're talking on a Sunday night, on a Monday night, on a Tuesday night. It's absolutely unbelievable. He has no idea what's going on.
I just wanted to touch briefly. I know, Ramita, you came very, very close to being caught by this. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just explain what happened in Madaya when you were there.
I was with three activists who were on the run. They were wanted by the government. They'd chosen this safe house because it had two escape routes, windows at the back, because they know that these places can be raided, their safe houses can be raided at any time. But what happened is, just several hours after we got to Madaya, I think 18,000 soldiers entered Madaya, surrounded Madaya. What usually happens is that the army will surround a town and they'll send the militia, the Shabiha, and security forces into the town to conduct violent house-to-house raids. And that's what happened. And using their system of lookouts, we just kept getting the news that the raids were getting nearer and nearer until finally they were going to be on our street. And they couldn't use the escape routes because there were militiamen armed outside each window. And they thought that there were snipers as well covering the window. So they thought they'd get shot if they ran out. So they had no choice but to hide in a tiny little cupboard where the water tank was. And that's the moment where I was really terrified, because you know how brave they are. Yeah. They're the bravest men I've ever met. So the moment you see that they're shaking with fear, and they just looked at me and said, look, if we get caught, we're going to be killed. Whatever you do, just distract them. Please don't let them anywhere near the cupboard. They were convinced we're going to get raided. And they told me, they gave me really strict instructions. Sit as far away from the door as possible. They're not going to knock. They're going to bash down the door and they're going to start beating you. So you need to hold your British passport up and you need to start shouting very loudly in English so they know that you're not Syrian. And then we heard the raids begin and it was horrific sound. It was hundreds of boots marching right outside the building, windows smashing, doors banging down and then screaming. And we could hear people getting beaten up. It was just, I think, potluck that they didn't bash down our door. We could hear them in our building. And it died down. The screaming died down. We later found out that they'd taken dozens and dozens, arrested dozens. Half of them are still disappeared. Nobody knows where these young men are, simply for having been at protests, never mind the activists we were with who wanted men. And we waited another 12 hours before we could actually leave the safe house because all the lookouts phoned to say that they were retreating.
The time bombs, there's a fear of sectarianism within Syria, which obviously ripped neighbouring Lebanon apart. Is that something you were aware of, that when you met these different opposition groups, that there was a religious affiliation?
Well, at the moment, I found that it's still in that really idealistic phase of it just being about free and fair elections and democracy, and they really want to stress that this is not about religion. But I think you can't hide from the fact that it's an Alawite minority who are doing the killing, and most of the people being killed are Sunnis. So I think it is a real fear.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's approaching the bottom of, it's just after the bottom of the hour here. And in the next half hour, we'll be hearing from Moscow, where the developers of Singapore's airport are getting on board with a Russian oligarch. But before that, the news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Emma. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso made a heartfelt appeal today for Greeks to unite behind the latest EU financial aid package. According to a government spokesman, the referendum proposed by the Prime Minister, George Papandreou, will ask Greeks to vote on the EU's new bailout deal for the debt-laden country rather than staying in the eurozone. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has warned there will be no hope for peace in his war-ravaged nation without help from its neighbours to combat terror groups. Investigators say pilot error caused a Russian jet crash that killed an entire professional ice hockey team. 44 people died when the aircraft crashed into the banks of the Volga River in central Russia in September. The Arab League says Syria has agreed to withdraw its military presence from cities and residential areas and to releasing prisoners as part of an Arab initiative to end 7 months of violence. Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh has moved a step closer to handing power to his deputy by accepting a UN formula to ease a transition and end an uprising against his rule. Opponents of Islamists declared a life-and-death battle for Egypt's future, as official campaigning began today, for parliamentary elections seen as vital for restoring stability after 8 months of fragile military rule. Russia lost tens of billions of dollars in potential revenues from arms deals with the Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's fall, the official in charge of Russia's arms export said today. Russia, the world's number two arms exporter, has frequently cited losses of $4 billion in Libyan arms contracts. A US jury has found the former Russian arms dealer, Viktor Bout, guilty on charges that he agreed to sell arms to people he thought were Colombian militants intent on attacking American soldiers. Britain's Duke and Duchess of Cambridge toured UNICEF's Global Supply Centre in Copenhagen today to call attention to the famine in East Africa. And Barack Obama topped Forbes' list of the world's most powerful people in 2011 as the US leader's clout rose after the deaths of the al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Well, earlier this week, the head of the British Monitoring Service, GCHQ, warned of a disturbing level of cyber attacks on the United Kingdom. This was then echoed by the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, who spoke of cyber attacks on an industrial scale. Well, London is currently playing host to an international cybersecurity conference, which is attracting figures from global business. And Paul Fisher is editor of SC Magazine. That's an international magazine for security professionals. He joins me live in the studio. A very warm welcome to you, Paul.
Thank you.
Just explain to me the scale upon which this cyber crime is occurring. Because once GCHQ and the British Prime Minister start making warnings like that, there's obviously something that needs to be acted upon.
That's true. I think also there's a slight element of exaggeration in this, which I wanted to say. The figure that the Prime Minister brought up was £27 billion a year, which is the cost to the UK. That's very difficult to actually verify. However, it's certainly true that this is a growing problem, not just here, but across the world.
And when you mean a growing problem, what kind of cybercrime are we talking about? Are we talking about a black economy with credit card details for sale? Because I had the chance to sit in a courtroom in London earlier on this year where four 14-year-olds were convicted of running a credit card sales website, and they only got caught when they tried to check into a luxury hotel. So you've got the low scale, low level crime, but then you have state sponsored crime. Give us a few examples of what kind of crime people are trying to solve.
Well, that's very true. It's so common now for credit cards to be stolen, or rather the numbers and bank account details, that they're sold online in these virtual markets for as little as 69 pence a set of numbers. That's what you might call traditional cybercrime, and it's purely for financial gain. It's just the online version of what's been happening for centuries.
That's entry-level cybercrime.
Well, almost, and it's the quickest way to make a quick buck. And there's also, it's become so sophisticated that cybercriminals will actually sell to other cybercriminals what they call rootkits, so that they actually make it easy for them to steal people's credit card details, etc. Or you can just buy them direct off these auction sites, which are quite easy to find.
I do. Well, when I saw these 14-year-olds, who, bless them, look so very wet behind the ears, they looked as if they wouldn't be able to be let out after 7 p.m. by their mums and dads, and yet they were. I think they made about £20,000 in a space of days. It's incredibly simple to do this.
Well, the fact that they're not being allowed out after 7 p.m. is probably why they're so good at it, because they're actually locked up in their bedrooms doing this. But more seriously, you mentioned the attacks, or state-sponsored attacks, which came up today and yesterday in this conference. Something that no one ever really wants to talk about. They don't want to point fingers. The government, William Hague, in his summing up today, was asked about who might be doing this in very pointed ways. Of course, when people talk about this, we're all actually talking about China. You won't get anyone from the Foreign Office or our government to admit that, because they don't want to upset the Chinese. But there is evidence, and it is a well-known fact within our circles, that there are people within China that are attacking US and British and European companies. And that's not for financial gain. That is to steal secrets, which is actually a lot more serious. And, and worse than that is attacks on what they call critical infrastructure, which wouldn't want to say that that's been done by any specific state. However, it is thought that this will become a weapon in any future war, that you'll be able to take out, say, a nuclear power station.
Now, when you mean the infrastructure, is this is this basically, let's say we have government information and it is kept private and kept secure by this infrastructure. Am I right in thinking that a lot of the information that's kept, although it's owned by the government, the information, the kit that keeps it private, it is in fact run by private companies? And is that where there's a problem arises?
Yes. I mean, it's not really whether it's owned by the government or not. I mean, the kit is all the same. You know, we buy it from whatever the vendors are. And that's what's being attacked. And that's the data is what they're after. So it doesn't really matter whether it's private or public. The actual equipment, or whatever you want to call it, the technology, is pretty much the same.
But to what degree are governments now willing to share information with private companies that can guarantee that they'll keep this information private?
Well, that's a good point, because, and this came up today, is that government departments are under pressure to save money, as is private industry. So they're moving stuff to the cloud, because that's a cheaper way of storing data. That's actually complicating the situation even worse, because these so-called clouds of data, you don't even know where they are. And they quite often will be looked after by companies the clouds are looked after by not just the company you bought it from, but probably another outsourced supplier.
You mentioned that countries cannot
be
named.
Sorry, my headphones are falling off.
You mentioned that countries are not being named as being the chief perpetrators, but then in the same breath you mentioned China.
Yes.
Were they at the show?
There were Chinese people there, certainly. In fact, and I tweeted this, during one of the sessions at the Q&A, a representative, I think he said he was from the Chinese Foreign Ministry, effectively made... He said he was asking a question. It turned out to be a very long statement of what sounded like, you show us the evidence that we're doing this and we'll take steps. Now, of course, as I said, people from the government won't name China. I'm probably going to get shot on the way out of this studio. I hope not. But,
we do hope you're not, yeah. As well.
But I don't think anyone listening to this would be totally surprised by the fact that it's not necessarily the Chinese government. But it could be people working on behalf of state actors, shall we say.
Now, you mentioned it's not the Chinese government, but that brings in the idea of a government actually participating in cybercrime. Because everything that we've talked about so far is attacks on a government and attacks on a nation, not by another nation, but by a private operator. But was there the Stuxnet virus from earlier on this year, which I think you probably explain this a little better to us, but there were accusations of one state acting on another state there, weren't there?
That was probably a turning point in what... That's something else, that's cyber warfare. It's different from cybercrime and cyber espionage, which is what I've been accused of the Chinese of doing, which is stealing basically intellectual property. Cyber warfare is, like you say, the Stuxnet attack on Iranian nuclear power plants. That, again, was rumored to be an Israeli joint, or actually a joint attack by Israel and America. It was a very, very highly sophisticated attack and highly targeted. They knew exactly what they wanted to do, and that was they found a vulnerability in these Siemens power plants, and they realized that by attacking that, they could set back the Iranian nuclear development program by several years, and they did.
They did something terribly simple, didn't they? They just sped up the speed of the centrifuges carrying out the experiments, got them so fast that they broke.
Essentially, yeah, they caused a mechanical reaction, which then broke them. And the other thing that's interesting is, again, at the conference, the high-level moral view was that we should not get involved in any of this. And that all states should, you know, come to some agreement that, you know, there won't be a cyber war arms race. But the fact is that they might do it to us, we'll do it to them. And you can bet that people down in GCHQ are working on cyber weapons right now.
It is unusual that you bring in the idea of a moral view, because in the last 5 minutes you've mentioned cybercrime, cyber espionage and cyber warfare. This conference has been about policing it, and a moral element does have to be introduced into it. So how do you introduce a moral element into policing this mess?
Well, I have to say the idea of the conference was actually very, you know, has to be commended. I think the idea was that we do have a problem. We're living in a cyber world, and there are certain people that are taking advantage of it. Certainly, no one would disagree with preventing child abuse online. No one would ever. I think the morality. There's probably not much morality in business. You know, I mean, companies have spied on each other for years. Now they're just using electronic means of doing it. And again, whilst I might sit here and accuse the Chinese, and we can talk about Israel and America and Iran and things. No nation wants to get left behind in this race.
So what positive steps can be done? Because William Hague has called on governments and the international law to join forces in sorting this out. But if everybody says, well, I won't spy on you, is it as simple as one country saying, well, I won't spy on you if you don't spy on me? I mean, how do you enforce that?
Well, they talked about having... I mean, this is the first of, I think, a series of conferences. They're going to do another one in Hungary next year and then in Korea. So I think they've... Hague talked about a London decree or something about what they came out of this conference. They'll try and come to some international agreement where each nation would agree not to do and this and that. But I'm quite cynical about that.
We should wait and see. Let's hope that the whole world joins together in London this week in one beautiful cyber technological loving, I hope. That was Paul Fisher. Thank you very much for joining us. Editor of SC Magazine, which is a cyber security... It's an international security magazine.
We're published in US and in Australia as well.
Thank you very much indeed,
Paul.
Well, the number one topic, as we've just been talking about at this week's cyber conference, has been China, the country that shall not be mentioned, and how to prevent it unleashing a wave of cyber attacks on military and business computer systems across the world. But let's wonder what life is like for the hackers themselves. Our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, has channeled the thoughts of a Chinese military cyber hacker.
To be honest, I feel cheated. I was told that this job was going to be exciting. I was told I would be performing a patriotic duty that would make me a hero of the masses. If you will allow me to be blunt, it was strongly suggested. I'd almost go as far as say promised that it would help me get girls. Which, as the sort of person who spends his day staring at a computer screen, gets his kicks out of analysing incredibly complicated computer coding patterns, and still lives with his mother, is, you understand, a rather tempting thought. Instead, here I am, at 2 o'clock in the morning, reading the contents of William Hague's office diary, which, I must inform you, is deeply dull. He's got a meeting with the Bulgarian ambassador in 2 hours, a courtesy phone call with the Foreign Minister of Finland after that, and then he's speaking at a local Conservative Party Association event about the big society, whatever that is. We members of the Chinese Blue Army take our jobs very seriously. You would expect nothing less. But I must confess, there are days when I wonder whether this cyber-hacking business is really worth it. Sure, there was that time when we intercepted emails between Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy, where they admitted they didn't have a clue what to do about the euro, but who needs hacked emails to know that? The only amusement to be had is checking in on Silvio Berlusconi's emails. Even then, it can be a bit of a letdown. For some reason, the internet filter here in Beijing prevents me opening most of them. They're not safe for work, apparently. Hacking is, of course, a serious business. We've broken into top US companies, the Pentagon, the European Central Bank, and the Elysee Palace. I once even hacked into Queen Elizabeth BlackBerry. She's a fierce BBMer, you know. No one is too powerful or too closely protected. But, and let's keep this between you and me, the vast majority of stuff that we uncover is, well, just rather boring. These people use the internet for the same thing that you do. Angela Merkel is never off her Facebook page. Nicolas Sarkozy uses Twitter on his iPhone when he's supposed to be chairing cabinet meetings. And Silvio Berlusconi is, well, I think we've probably covered that. So next time you hear some scary Reds in the Laptops propaganda about the fearsome Blue Army from China, just remember this. There is some poor sap, i.e. me, in a small cubicle in Beijing, wondering if he'll ever meet the girl of his dreams, and watching repeats of James Bond, whose only source of enjoyment is sending out Nigerian-style scam emails from Barack Obama's private email account.
That was our resident Chinese military cyber hacker Steve Bloomfield checking in on Silvio Berlusconi's emails. He's also our foreign editor too. We'll be back in a moment here on Monocle 24. Stay with us.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24. And also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London. I'm Emma Nelson. The time is just coming up to, let's have a look, it's 12 minutes up to the hour. Let's have a bit of music. Give Your Love a Chance by Shuyu Okino. Shuyu Okino there with Give Your Love a Chance here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Well, we move now to the subject of Russian aviation on Midori House, currently plagued by a terrible safety record. There have been more crashes this year than any other country in the world. The Russians are now keen to improve their airports, and in particular those outside Moscow. The Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska and his investment firm Basic Element has teamed up with Changi Airports International. They're the firm that revolutionised Singapore's airport just a few years ago. And they're looking at the area of Krasnodar, which is near the Black Sea. Now, to give us some more details about what these firms are planning to do, we're joined on the line by the Moscow Times correspondent, Roland Oliphant. He's joining us on the line from Russia, so there might be a bit of a delay, I imagine. Roland, a very warm welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much.
Just explain to us what this deal between Changi Basic Element, which is Deripaska's firm, and there's a Russian bank as well involved in it. What does this deal involve?
Well, essentially, Oleg Deripaska's Basic Element holding, which has all kinds of companies, mostly aluminium, but also has a subdivision that controls 4 airports in the Krasnodar region next to the Black Sea. He wants to develop it, so he's formed a joint venture with Changi, who are investing some money, and with Sberbank, which is Russia's largest state-owned bank. The bank and Changi are putting in the money. Deripaska is putting in the airports, as it were, and together they're going to create a joint venture which is going to manage these airports and, they say, develop a Singapore-style international hub in the south of Russia.
Now, Deripaska invested and he bought the Krasnodar airports about quite a few years ago. Why does he think such a hub will be a success?
Well, Krasnodar is kind of, it's an up-and-coming region in many ways, especially because it's the home of Sochi, which is going to be hosting the Sochi 2014 Winter Olympics. The entire region is subject to a kind of huge infrastructure effort to get it ready for that right now. There is going to be a lot of business, and the chief of Sabea Bank said, this is a financial investment for us, and we see a lot of potential for the Sochi Olympics and obviously for 2018 when Russia will host the World Cup. It's also generally kind of the Russian Riviera. If you look at the geography, it's the northeast of the Black Sea. It has a wonderful climate. So I think simply he sees a lot of added value in developing this place, especially, and this is really the key point, that if you've ever been to a regional Russian airport outside Moscow, it's difficult to underestimate just how basic it is. I mean, a lot of these places are kind of glorified bus stations with a runway. So it doesn't take much imagination to think you could snap up these reasonably cheaply, develop them and make quite a profit.
So to what extent does Deripaska want to make this a challenge to Moscow's airport?
I don't know about a challenge. Passenger numbers are increasing all the time in Russia. I think we've seen about 13% growth in passenger turnover this year. It's always going up. There's only two real airports in the country which are kind of Western serious international standard. They're both in Moscow. And to be honest, I don't think they'd be too worried. I think there is an opportunity, but I think there's plenty of business to go around. I wouldn't see it as a challenge so much as certainly an opportunity.
And what kind of opportunity are we talking about? I mean, you mentioned the Russians having an expanding aviation industry, but obviously the Russians need to look externally. So how are they going to play into the European and the Asian hands?
Well, again, if you look at that geography, it's right on the border of kind of Europe and Asia. It's really the southeastern corner of Europe. And I think what they're looking into is airlines that would connect via the Krasnodar region to Siberia, Central Russia, Central Asia, the Middle East, maybe even as far as India. It's a huge area and kind of underserviced. Most of those flights would go through Moscow at the moment.
I'm terribly sorry, Roland. We're going to have to cut you short there because we're running out of time. You've been listening to Midori House. That was Roland Oliphant from the Moscow Times. Join us tomorrow at the same time.